Beslam Radio, and you can find programs there. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Communique. Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who is also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect? That Epstein and his close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffray, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffray's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail, but unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously, and there was no investigation. It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities. There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird. Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail. As we were saying earlier, he was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad, and Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right, Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. And just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, "You spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit?" Ben Menashe replies that, quote, "Because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answered to." The interviewer then continues, "Would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well?" Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends. And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israel Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel, and one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years, and he investigated online basically child trafficking and child pornography and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. You want to understand how the ruling elites operate? Start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to that Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off, and that's why he gave him a very lenient case, a charge. Basically, he got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein's would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman? The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child. And they would then invest in Epstein's. He had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage. So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, you know, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it, we have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So that's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, you know, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you are, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is Ghislaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre and Maria Farmer and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Ghislaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, you know, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv. Right. And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said in an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote CIA asset, right? And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him. And I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no. But if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein, and then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. They don't have, that person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad. His first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone that mattered. And they did this in service of Israeli intelligence. They did this at the behest of the Mossad. And again, that's not only speculation. This is now confirmed. It's on the record, confirmed by former Israeli intelligence officials, as we were just going through. And so in addition to all of the already vile, deplorable sexual assaults that this entire saga is mired with, we can see now that there is very clearly a political dimension to it as well. And the fact that the media won't talk about this and never tackle this angle, it really speaks volumes, right? Why do they refuse to talk about this? And how come, despite unsealing so many documents, the courts still continue to keep many of them under wraps? What are they hiding from us exactly? And what could be the other dark secrets in the spy world that we're yet to discover? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal jeopardy about the 6th of January insurrection is growing, but experts say Attorney General Merrick Garland must move carefully. We now present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Is Trump in His Sights? Garland Under Pressure to Charge Ex-President. The U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland is facing more political pressure to move faster and expand the U.S. Department of Justice's investigation into the January 6th Capitol attack and charge Donald Trump and some of his former top aides. With mounting evidence from the January 6th House panel, court rulings and news reports that Donald Trump engaged in a criminal conspiracy in his aggressive drive to thwart Joe Biden's election win in 2020, Merrick Garland and his staff face an almost unique decision, whether to charge a former U.S. president. However, former Justice Department officials caution that while there's growing evidence of criminal conduct by Donald Trump to obstruct Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win on 6th of January 2021 and defraud the government, building a strong case to prove Trump's corrupt intent, a necessary element to convict him, probably requires more evidence and more time. In an important speech in January of this year, Merrick Garland said he would hold all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable, if they were present at the Capitol that day or not, who were responsible for this assault on our democracy, which suggested to some ex-prosecutors that Donald Trump and some of his allies were in his sights. But rising pressures on Merrick Garland to move faster with a clearer focus on Donald Trump and his top allies have come from Democrats on the House panel investigating the Capitol attack. Those concerns were underscored recently when the House sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department charging contempt of Congress by two Trump aides, trade advisor Peter Navarro and communications chief Dan Scavino, who refused to cooperate after being subpoenaed. Panel member Adam Schiff said, "We are upholding our responsibility. The Department of Justice must do the same." Likewise, Congresswoman Elaine Luria urged Merrick Garland to do your job so we can do ours. About 4 months ago, the House sent a criminal contempt of Congress referral to the Justice Department for the former White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, but so far he has not been indicted. However, some former top Department of Justice officials and prosecutors claim that Merrick Garland is moving correctly and expeditiously in pursuing all criminal conduct to overturn Biden's election in its sprawling January 6 inquiry. The former Justice Inspector General, Michael Bromwich, told The Guardian, "When people, including many lawyers, criticize the Department of Justice for not more clearly centering the January 6 investigation on Donald Trump, they are expressing impatience rather than a clear understanding of the trajectory of the investigation." He added, "Department of Justice is methodically building the case from the bottom up. It is almost surely the most complex criminal investigation in the nation's history, involving the most prosecutors, the most investigators, the most digital evidence, and the most defendants." Bromwich added that people view the scores of ongoing criminal prosecutions of participants in the January 6th insurrection as somehow separate from the investigation of Donald Trump. They are not. He is the subject of the investigation at the top of the pyramid. People need to carefully watch what is happening, not react based on their impatience. The department's investigation is the biggest one ever. More than 750 people have been charged so far with federal crimes, and about 250 individuals have pleaded guilty. Still concerns about the pace of the investigation and why charges have not been filed against Donald Trump have been spurred in part by a few revelations over the last couple of months. Last month, for instance, federal judge David Carter, in a crucial court ruling involving a central Trump legal advisor, John Eastman, stated that Trump more likely than not broke the law in his weeks-long drive to stop Joe Biden from taking office. Judge David Carter wrote in a civil case which resulted in an order for John Eastman to release more than 100 emails he had withheld from the House panel, "Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history." Similarly, the 6th of January Select Committee made a 61-page court filing on 2nd of March this year that implicated Trump in a criminal conspiracy to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win. On another legal front that could implicate Trump and some of his top allies, the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, revealed in January that the Department of Justice was starting a criminal investigation into a sprawling scheme, reportedly spearheaded by Trump's ex-lawyer Rudy Giuliani and Trump campaign aides, to replace legitimate electors for Joe Biden with false ones pledged to Trump in 7 states that Biden won. Further, the Washington Post reported recently that the Department of Justice had begun looking into the funding and organizing of the January 6th Save America rally in Washington involving some Trump allies. Donald Trump repeated his false claims at the rally that the election was stolen. Trump falsely told the cheering crowd, "We won this election and we won it by a landslide." He said, "You don't concede when there is theft involved," urging the large crowd to fight like hell shortly before the Capitol attack by hundreds of his supporters that led to 140 injured police officers and several deaths. Meanwhile, a Trump spokesperson, Taylor Budowich, has called the House January 6 inquiry a circus of partisanship. And Taylor Budowich attacked Judge David Carter's ruling as absurd and baseless, noting that Judge Carter was a Clinton-appointed judge in California. Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor, told The Guardian that recent actions by the House January 6 panel and by the Department of Justice, along with court opinions, have notably increased legal threats to Donald Trump. It said anyone would need ice in their veins not to feel the heat when all three branches of the federal government are breathing down your neck. On the issue of whether Donald Trump may be indicted, Donald Eyre, who served as Deputy Attorney General in the George H.W. Bush administration, said, "The critical question should be whether there is adequate proof of wrongdoing intent." Citing Judge Carter's ruling that Trump more likely than not broke the law, Donald Eyre said that the evidence of such intent has recently become a lot stronger. Nonetheless, Eyre and Aftergut stressed that Attorney General Merrick Garland has to juggle competing priorities lest he politicizes his department, while being extra careful to ensure any charges he may bring against Donald Trump will stand up in court. Aftergut said Merrick Garland's between the rock of defending one Justice Department ideal and the hard place of protecting another. On the one hand, no person is above the law. On the other hand, the department needs to avoid, as much as possible, consistent with the first ideal, appearing political. Aftergut said, "There's nothing easy about the position of Merrick Garland is in. The safest course before considering a prosecution of a former president would be to demand considerably more evidence of guilt than you'd require in any other case." Donald Eyre added, "Merrick Garland is right not to be discussing the specifics of whether and how Donald Trump may be indicted, a stance Garland has adopted to protect the Department of Justice's credibility as not political." At the same time, Donald Eyre suggested that Merrick Garland should spend more time talking to the country about impartial justice and the idea that no person is above the law. There are clear risks in moving too fast to appease critics. The former federal prosecutor, Michael Zeldin, said Merrick Garland must make his decisions based on the law in relation to the facts. The more politicians endeavor to pressure Garland to act, it runs the risk that any decision Garland makes will be seen as politically motivated rather than based on purely legal considerations. That seems to fit with Merrick Garland's approach. In his 5th of January speech this year, Garland emphasized, "We follow the physical evidence, we follow the digital evidence, we follow the money. But most important of all, we follow the facts, not an agenda or an assumption. The facts tell us where to go next. And if there is enough evidence, following the rules could end up with Donald Trump getting charged."
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
You know how, like, especially the past decade-ish, specifically with the advent of social media, you get these, like, hashtag healthy lifestyle, hashtag vegan lifestyle, hashtag keto lifestyle, hashtag whatever the fudge lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
Yeah. And I look at them and I feel like I'm not sure. Maybe veganism can be practiced as a lifestyle to an extent, where, you know, you don't use leather in your clothing, you don't use any animal parts in your tools and instrument, whether you're a musician or whatever, in your food. And that encompasses more than one aspect of your life, leading it to become an overall lifestyle for you to an extent that's more understandable. But it's a keto lifestyle. I definitely don't understand. You just got a keto diet. Mm-hmm. You don't got a keto lifestyle, right? And then there's Islamic lifestyle.
True.
Why do they call it that? Is it because, like, again, it covers more than one aspect of your life? every aspect of your life.
I think every aspect of your life for me.
But then again, if that's what lifestyle means, the style of your life is Islamic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that the objective of Islam to begin with? Why do you got to glue the word lifestyle to it? You're Muslim, period. Islam is a lifestyle.
Islam is a lifestyle itself, yeah.
Right? Because if you're...
The way of life.
If you're Islamic, mm-hmm. then you're Islamic. You're in your diet, obviously. We've got very strict dietary standards. You're Islamic in your clothes. You're Islamic in your interaction. You're Islamic in your politics, in your economy.
Whatever you do.
Yes. You're Islamic in your... relationships, your Islamic in your
conversations,
in your child rearing and child upbringing, your education,
your deeds.
Yeah, because Islam has a set of do's and don'ts for all of these aspects of your life. So it already is a lifestyle. You don't necessarily got to say Islamic lifestyle.
Yeah.
Just say Islamic.
Yeah, I understand what you're trying to say.
I don't know why. It just irks me a little when they say Islamic lifestyle. Islam is a lifestyle. Go get your facts straight.
Maybe they're referring to the lifestyle of Muslims by saying that. Yeah?
Yeah, now I get it. This is why we have these discussions, you guys. How Islamic do you think your lifestyle is? Or how do you think you're having an Islamic lifestyle?
By just working on the do's and don'ts of Islam in all my, whatever I do, like the way I even think to the way I act. I think in everything. For example, if you ask me personally, the way I dress up, the way I talk, sometimes I want to be very furious at someone and just not being furious and being patient at that time.
It's the Islamic lifestyle.
Of course. Of course, it tells you like to calm down, to chill.
Be patient.
And you know, having good intentions about people. If someone, I get very much irked with this thing, if someone is talking at your back and you get to know...
I don't mind it when people talk behind my back.
No, people talk behind your back or do some anything bad to you. And then we have this very, very beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam who says that give 70 positive assumptions. Yes. Maybe.
And that changes everything. It's such a game changer.
Such a game changer thing. Maybe this person did this thing because of this. We don't even say one maybe to ourselves.
And 70 is like a big number. And 70. Excuse you me, but Imam Ali doesn't exaggerate. He's a ma'soom.
Yeah.
When he says 70, he means 70.
He means that. And I think 70 is a great number. We don't even say to ourselves seven times. We don't give 70 positive assumptions.
Our first reaction is that I'm a burn his house down.
Exactly. So I think if... we don't even like listen to the person why he did that. Because even if sometimes we listen to that, maybe things will change again. But yes, Islamic lifestyle. Islamic lifestyle teaches you the way you should deal with the things, especially the things that can just be more destroying, like this, your furiousness, being impatient, being so rebellious and all. So... I think here Islamic lifestyle plays a very key role.
Well, I know a lot of people who aren't Muslims, but they're like that still. Maybe they won't go as far as, you know, 70. But they're still like that. They're just good people. So I'm feeling like there has to be something that differentiates, discerns between being just a good person or a good Muslim.
Yeah.
What is it that...
makes you a good Muslim?
What's that specific factor that discerns them, you know, sets them apart? A person who's just a good person and a person who's a good
What differentiates them?
Yes, and I think it's their intention.
Wow.
Al-a'mal bi-niyat. Your actions are based on your intention.
Intention.
Right?
Well.
And a good Muslim is all of that and much more with the intention of satisfying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Well,
right?
Yes.
But a good person is just that for the sake of being a good person. I'm not undermining it. I'm not lessening its value. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. You're a good person. More power to you. Kudos to you. I'm totally supporting that. I'm totally for that. I mean,
but
for
the
reals.
Intention of a good Muslim differs.
It differs. And
he is doing that with the intention of doing it for Allah.
And it's, I think it's everlasting.
Yeah.
It renders the action utterly eternal.
True.
And a Muslim lifestyle, an Islamic lifestyle, means to have an incorporeal, infinite, eternal mindset toward your existence.
True.
And to understand that whatever you do is not only limited mm-hmm. to your life on this planet, and that it has the potential to last forever. You guys are listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
How do you think personally you are Islamic?
If I could rate myself on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say...
No, in terms of your actions. I don't want you to scale yourself. Mm. Like, scaling or judging is the job of the...
Creator.
Himself. And I just want to know through your deeds, like your actions that you do and that you personally do.
Do I consider myself living an Islamic lifestyle?
True.
You see, here's the thing. Because I've had both. I used to have a non-Islamic lifestyle.
Oh.
Right? And then God smacked me in the back of the head and I repented. And now I have this lifestyle.
Wow.
And they were like day and night. So this is how I know how much it's changed. Because I had the non-Islamic lifestyle, and I don't have that, and it was so different from the lifestyle I have now, I can tell that, oh yeah, my lifestyle is pretty Islamic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I know what the non-Islamic looks like. I would say, yeah, it's pretty Islamic.
Well, I can see you in front of my eyes right now.
Exactly.
And I can say, in terms of your wearings, in terms of your looks... That's Islamic.
Yeah, that's Islamic enough, right? I think it shows itself more when you're a woman compared to a man, right?
Yeah.
Because we have got that whole hijab thing going on and men don't. But though I personally believe, based on my studies and research, based on hardcore facts, that men have a degree of hijab too. But
I wish we have this discussion.
Round table debate sort of thing.
What do you think, since you said that you had both the lifestyles. Mm-hmm. What do you think is a better part of this?
The best part of having an Islamic lifestyle?
Yeah.
Oh, I would say the sense of meaning and purpose that comes with it. And I'm digging that. I love that so much. And the sense of peace that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you develop the sort of lifestyle for yourself and you give direction and meaning to every aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
based on the doctrine and the principle and the axiom and the ideology that you've adopted, you just feel so much more comfortable with yourself.
True. You know, Zainab, I would want you to tell here for our listeners that most people who think non-Islamic, mm-hmm. who live in non-Islamic states and all, they think the people, the youth, or, you know, whosoever has Islamic way of life, Islamic lifestyle, it is mostly, you know, based on that follow-up thing. It's something that's got nothing to do with your logic. Like, you have to do it with your logic.
Mm.
That's what I'm trying to say. The people who are non-Islamic, who do not know.
Well, you know, I think that's a very ignorant way of looking at it. Because,
you know, people think that they are blindly following exactly. something. Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say.
This is what I'm saying. From where I'm standing, it's just it's the same as
because you referring to a professional. Line, when I asked you what's the best thing, you used the line with the purpose and the meaning.
Mm.
The purpose and meaningful acts that you do. With what purpose does your logic support that?
It was totally a logical journey for me.
So?
It was an absolute logical journey because otherwise it wouldn't be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just a spur of a moment sort of thing.
Like, well, blind eye following.
Yeah, thing. And like a stir of emotions that occurred, mm-hmm. then it wouldn't last at all.
True.
So it was definitely a logical journey, and it's just a matter of referring to a professional
mm-hmm.
in certain fields that I have. It's just out of my field of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have the faculty to know the ruling regarding every single thing that happens in life.
True.
The actual, like, jurisprudential ruling of it.
True.
So I refer to an expert.
Yeah.
Like, you refer to a doctor, you refer to a lawyer, you refer to an IT expert.
I was saying that people think, non-Islam, those who live in non-Islamic states, think that we are always in a state of referring, while as we are not. Like, so many times Quran says, go for tafakkarun,
tadabbarun, comprehend and reflect and
exactly
contemplate and do soul searching. All that is very important. We're so out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us, you guys. This has been Youth Station. On behalf of the cast and crew, I bid you all goodbye and farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness. And my love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.